You are listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 13th of March 2024 on Monocle Radio. It is 2100 in Tokyo, 1300 in Strasbourg, midday here in London, and 8 a.m. in Washington, D.C. You're listening to Monocle Radio. The Briefing starts now. Hello and welcome to The Briefing. We're live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Chris Chermak. Coming up on today's program:
Joe Biden is on the run from his record and lying like crazy to try and escape accountability for the horrific devastation he and his party have created.
We can expect plenty more rhetoric along the same lines between now and November, as Donald Trump and Joe Biden have now officially secured their party's nominations for president. After that,
the aim is to make artificial intelligence secure, trustworthy, and make sure that it serves people.
European Commissioner Margrethe Vestager there on a landmark AI bill making its way through the European Parliament. We'll also have a newspaper roundup. We'll hear from France's ambassador to the United States. And we'll ask what a failed Japanese rocket launch means for the commercial space industry. All that right here on The Briefing with me, Chris Chermak. Last night in the United States, the matchup that many Americans are dreading became official. Donald Trump and Joe Biden both secured enough delegates to become their party's nominee for president, Biden with a win in Georgia and Trump with a victory in Washington state. And with that, the general election campaign is now formally underway. Expect more rallies like the one in Georgia earlier this week, where both candidates laid into each other. Scott Lucas is an adjunct professor at the Clinton Institute, University College Dublin. He joins me now. Scott, let's just step back for a moment here. I mean, 1 year ago or 2 years ago, would you have predicted this is the matchup we were going to get for 2024?
I think Biden being the Democratic nominee was pretty much baked in from the time that he decided around 2022 that he was not going to be just a one-term president, which he had indicated he would be, and he would go for a second term. And that is, the maxim is, you know, when you have an incumbent president, you dance with who brung you. If you have a challenge to the incumbent president, it weakens them, and it quite likely means they won't win the general election. You know, it's something that we saw with Gerald Ford, with the Republicans in 76, with the Democrats, with Jimmy Carter back in 1980. But I think whether or not Trump would be standing as Republican nominee, you know, was always as unpredictable as Trump himself is. I mean, there was no doubt that Trump was going to try to get back into the White House. But the question was, you know, given that he had effectively tried to hold on to that office with an attempted coup in 2021, given the numerous legal charges against him, you know, the civil and criminal charges, would that baggage be too much politically? And clearly, the Trumpists still have such a hold on the Republican Party, arguably an ascendancy on the Republican Party, that at least to get him back into the position of being a nominee, even as he faces those 91 felony charges, even as he continues to deny the 2020 election outcome, he's the person that they're going to have at the dance in November as well.
Well, before we get to Trump, I did want to just follow up on Joe Biden. I mean, was that decision in itself a surprise for you a couple of years ago that he decided he would want to run for another term? There was a time where he had suggested he'd be a transitional president, and there were various noises within the party perhaps suggesting that he should not do this.
No, because it's hard to give up power. I'm struggling to think the last U.S. incumbent president who didn't run for a second term. And indeed, the same is true with senators and congressmen, that they tend to stay in there until they're defeated rather than stepping aside. I think possibly the one person who could have advised against Biden running for a second term would have been Jill, his wife. Very influential person, an educator, an activist in her own right. But, you know, she apparently has supported his decision to run, and that kind of was baked in. And there was nothing anyone could do, you know, not even Kamala Harris, who some saw as the heir apparent as vice president, to try to reverse that decision.
Now, when it does come to Donald Trump, you've been very vocal about the threat to democracy that he poses. I wonder if that's even really understood at this point. It feels like even with, you know, 8 months to the election, that at the moment it's almost like just another campaign issue. Even Democrats are more likely to focus on, say, the economy and abortion over the next 8 months than they are on democracy specifically.
No, it is an issue. I mean, and I say, please don't fall into the media trap of trying to, you know, go with the white noise, whether it's Biden's age, whether it's Trump's insults, to think it's not an issue. For example, in exit polls on Super Tuesday, which we had last week, you know, in most of the states, people were saying, look, healthcare is one of our key issues. Education is one of our key issues. Some of them were citing the economy. Some of them were citing immigration. A lot were citing women's rights, which I think may be the number one issue this year, but they were also citing democracy. And Joe Biden, I think in that State of the Union address last week, one reason why that State of the Union was so effective is that Biden spent almost 10 minutes out of the hour outlining what was meant by that challenge to democracy and freedom. I'm not saying that, you know, it will prevent Trump from winning the election in November. You know, a lot of people are in with him come hell or high water. But I do think a lot of American voters do realize that this man is presenting them with a choice between Donald Trump in person and between the U.S. system, and there is no in-between.
Even if there is this recognition that democracy is on the ballot, as it were, which is an incredible thing in itself in the U.S., do you expect anything to kind of move the needle over the next 8 months on that? Because, you know, frankly, there's a lot of Trump voters who would agree that democracy is on the ballot, but that's because they're convinced that, say, the 2020 election was a fraud. I mean, is there anything that is going to change people's minds on that to impact this election?
Absolutely. I mean, and again, one of the problems we fall into in the media is because you get the mythical idea of the Trump base and we stop there. Now, it is true that, you know, a section of the American public, I know some of them personally, are diehard Trumpists and who will back him, as he put it in 2015, even if he shot a man in the middle of Fifth Avenue. But there's also a group of Americans who would not support Trump in any case, irrespective of what he did leading up to January 6, 2021. But the largest group of Americans are voters in the middle. You do have moderate Republicans who are not convinced of Trump. You do have Democrats who are not convinced of Biden, but the biggest section of Americans are those who identify as independents. And independents aren't just simply one-issue voters. You know, they can walk and chew gum at the same time. So they could come to the polls, you know, motivated by issues like immigration or the economy or healthcare or foreign policy. But they can also come to the polls thinking that given the ongoing criminal cases against Trump, and especially given the fact that he continues to say that the 2020 election was fraudulent with absolutely no evidence, that he continues to insult the judges, insult the district attorneys, insult the juries who are trying the criminal cases. And given that he has said on day one, I will be a dictator, yeah, some of those voters might take notice.
Well, and just finally, Scott, I wonder what your view is of third party candidates and whether they could shake up this race at all. No Labels is this sort of moderate middle centrist group that will start their nomination process tomorrow. And then we, of course, also have Robert Kennedy, a sort of anti-vaxxer who's in the race. How could both of those potentially shake up this race?
You know, I think in theory that the idea is that No Labels, because it would probably draw support from moderate Republicans who are never Trumpers, could hurt the Democrats. But, you know, let's see who their nominee is and let's see if the campaign has legs. I think far more serious at this point is the challenge of Robert Kennedy because of his name. For what it's worth, you know, he's getting about between 10 and 15% in polls right now. But the issue here is you can't say whether Robert Kennedy will draw from Democrats or draw from Republicans because, quite frankly, you know, Robert Kennedy Jr. might have the name, but he ain't got a lick of common sense. And his stance on the issues is that of a conspiracy theorist, especially denying coronavirus and indeed denying things, for example, such as 9/11. You know, and how many people are going to last the course with Bobby Kennedy if he continues to be off the charts in what he's saying, even more off the charts than what Trump says at times?
We will have another 8 months of this until November. Plenty of time to get into other issues as well. But thanks very much, Scott. That was Scott Lucas. Now here's Emma Searle with the day's other news headlines.
Thanks, Chris. An ally of the late Russian opposition figure, Alexei Navalny, has been attacked with a hammer outside his home in Lithuania. Leonid Volkov's team has since claimed the assault was politically motivated, while Volkov vowed to continue his campaign against Russian President Vladimir Putin. Sudan's army has retaken the headquarters of the state broadcaster, a significant breakthrough in its 11-month war with the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces. The building in the city of Omdurman is just across the Nile from the capital Khartoum. A Japanese-made rocket exploded shortly after its launch in a setback to Tokyo-based Space One's goal to become the first Japanese company to put a satellite into orbit. The solid-fuel rocket blasted off from western Japan, carrying an experimental government satellite. Those are today's headlines. Back to you, Chris.
Thanks very much, Emma. We'll have more on that last story later on in the show. But for now, to Strasbourg and the seat of the European Parliament, which faces elections in June as well. But before we get to those elections, the Parliament is also due to pass a series of bills that could have major implications for Europeans, including a landmark AI bill. Our foreign editor, Alexis Self, is in Strasbourg today for the occasion, and he joins us now. Lex, great to have you on the show from Strasbourg. Let's start with looking at the EU's AI Act. It's among the first of its kind. What does it do?
Bonjour, Chris. So the act was passed about 45 minutes ago in the hemicycle by an overwhelming majority. There were 523 MEPs in favour, only 46 against, with 49 abstaining. This is the first ever legal framework dedicated to regulating artificial intelligence. So the EU wants to lead the way on this new technology. And the main thing it does is create four levels of risk for artificial intelligence technologies. At the bottom of the scale is minimal risk, things like AI-enabled video games or spam filters, which are allowed without regulation. And at the top, you have unacceptable risk, things like social scoring, which is using AI to evaluate a person's trustworthiness based on their behavior, which the Chinese government is accused of doing. Stuff like that will be banned, and enforcement will be handled by a new office inside the European Commission, the AI office, which will be advised by independent experts and empowered to hand out fines.
And there is some debate over whether this AI bill, despite the fact that it was passed overwhelmingly, whether it's sort of too strong or not strong enough. They are also hoping to set some sort of global standard. What's the aim behind it in your mind?
Well, sure. I mean, I should have caveated the overwhelming majority with a kind of with an understanding that, you know, legislation doesn't really come before a vote in the EU Parliament unless the people who are proposing it know that it will be passed, because up until that point it's been the subject of, you know, much horse trading and watering down and compromise in order to get it to this stage. You know, Strasbourg, these plenary sessions in Strasbourg, which there are 12 of which a year, are just concerned with voting on legislation. MEPs come here to pass legislation. So everyone knew that the AI Act would be passed before it was put up for a vote. I spoke yesterday to the co-rapporteur of the Act, who's an Italian MEP called Brando Benife, and he said the big thing that the Act is trying to do is develop a human-centric approach to AI and to try to ensure that humans can only benefit from this technology. But the Parliament's big thing is also that European values are enshrined in the regulation of AI. Unfortunately, one European value that some critics might say has definitely been enshrined in this is overly cautious compromise. Now, you might say this is essential when you have 705 parliamentarians representing 27 member states, hugely divergent in terms of culture, geography, political culture, you know, and what the parliamentarians are attempting to sell back to their nation. But, you know, I spoke to Marcel Kolaja, a Czech MEP this morning from the Pirate Party, and he said, you know, that while he agreed with almost everything in the Act, because it was regulated rather than being outright banned, biometric data collection was included but regulated rather than banned, he had to vote against it.
Just a quick follow-up on that, Lex. I mean, on the one hand, as you say, there's, you know, the question of whether compromise weakens this. But at the same time, I mean, no other country has been able to agree on any kind of standard. How aware are these MEPs that the world is watching?
Yeah, I think every MEP believes, well, apart from maybe the more Eurosceptic ones, believes that what they're doing here is a good thing, and in the power of this legislation, and especially in it being, you know, the first of its kind. I went last night to a dinner of the Socialists and Democrats group where there was another piece of legislation being discussed. There were MEPs in attendance who gave a Q&A session on another piece of legislation, which was the corporate due diligence legislation. Now, that sets a standard for things like greenwashing and, you know, supply chains, and ensuring that European companies have not only green but also ethical supply chains. Now, that's a piece of legislation that you would argue is a good thing. But because the elections are coming up, because certain countries are trying to position themselves, or certain ruling parties are trying to position themselves as pro-business, especially the government of the country in which we are in, which is France, which is Mr. Macron, you know, in order for the act to have been brought here this week, they had to compromise, they had to do deals, and they thought it was going to pass. And now all of a sudden, Mr. Macron, in a kind of pro-business jerk towards the end, is now holding up the law, and it's looking like it's not going to be passed. So this is the kind of compromises, this is the kind of horse trading that must be done in the EU. And some would argue that it's a defining feature of the EU, but it's also why the EU isn't as efficient or as effective as it could be.
Just finally, Lex, I mean, one other aspect of this is sort of the fight over the balance of power between the European Union's executive, the Commission, and the Parliament. The Parliament is suing the European Commission over providing funds to Hungary. What can you tell us about that?
Well, again, I mean, I don't want to keep repeating myself, but, you know, some would argue that the reason that the Commission is releasing these funds, one third of the funds that Hungary is supposedly owed, is because von der Leyen is up for re-election, or rather, well, she's not up for re-election, and that's a big point of contention in the parliamentary elections, that the Commission president isn't actually on the list of candidates, but rather the group that she represents within the parliament, the European People's Party, is trying to win a majority again. And in order to do that, it's having to do deals with parties such as those in Hungary, and part of that is releasing funds to the Hungarian government. Now, most parliamentarians I've spoken to in the 2 days that I've been here strongly disagree with that move. But again, this is, and so therefore they voted to sue the Commission. But again, you know, because of the procedure involved, because of the different, you know, the different committees and bodies that these kind of actions must go through, it isn't expected that they'll be successful in the near future in that regard.
Alexis Self, thank you very much for joining us from Strasbourg. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. You are back with The Briefing, and I'm Chris Chermak. Time for a look now at some of the day's newspapers with the correspondent and campaigner, Catherine Carpenter. Catherine, great to have you on the show. We're going to start here in the UK. The government is going to pay failed asylum seekers to move to Rwanda.
Hi, Chris. Yes, this was a scoop initially by the Times newspaper. It's being reported all over the place now. If you think you've heard this Rwanda story before, it is a little bit different this time. This time, the UK government is proposing to pay failed asylum seekers, as you said, up to £3,000 to move to Rwanda. So these are people who have had their asylum claims processed, for whatever reason, cannot return to their home country. They will be given the option voluntarily to move to Rwanda and have what's being called an assistance payment to facilitate that. Now, this isn't a completely new thing, in that the UK government does already give cash to people whose claims have been rejected if they want to return to their home country. The extension in this case is to people who can't go to their home country for whatever reason. And this is completely separate to the policy that has had so much airtime in the media about the UK wanting to deport people who've come here to the UK illegally to have their claims processed in Rwanda. So a different policy, same country, and I should imagine likely to face some of the same hurdles that we're seeing the previous Rwanda policy face. But the UK government does have an issue. It, last year it rejected the Home Office nearly 31,000 asylum claims, only 19,000 people offered for their resettlement home. So there might be a few takers for this, but I think we've got to ask ourselves why this is being put out onto our airwaves today in the context of what Rishi Sunak is facing in terms of heading for an election and currently embroiled in a big race row here in London.
Well, Catherine, let's move on to one other story. We were just talking before this segment about AI and a bill in the European Union, the European Parliament. But India's Narendra Modi government is also looking to regulate AI ahead of national elections there.
That's right. Al Jazeera reporting on that, amongst others, today. The Indian government is now asking tech companies to seek approval before they launch any new AI models or tools, where these are unreliable or untested. Now, this has partly come about because the Google Gemini tool came up with some less than favorable answers, if you're Prime Minister Modi, to some questions related to the election. The Indian government previously said it was going to be quite light touch on this. It's now sort of appears to be changing that approach, and it's warning companies that their AI products should not generate answers that threaten the integrity of the electoral process. Now, there has been a response to this. We know Google already has said it's going to restrict its Gemini AI chatbot from answering election-related questions in lots of countries where voting is taking place this year. So the US, South Africa, here in the UK, as well as in India. So this issue of AI and its role in elections and how it might impact on us, the voters, wherever we are in the world, is one that is going to run and run.
Catherine, one final story to look at. Picasso's Lover is finally getting her own exhibition in the Picasso Museum in Paris. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I love this one. A delicious tale of getting a kind of revenge on your ex from beyond the grave. Some of our listeners will have heard of Françoise Gillot. She was Picasso's partner, lover for 10 years. They had two children together. She decided to leave him for a multitude of reasons. She famously recounted that he said, "One doesn't leave a man like me," but she did. She upped and off. She went to the United States. And Picasso then, she says, tried to sabotage her career. He persuaded galleries not to show or sell her work. He tried to stop her book about their relationship being published. She died last year in New York at the age of 101, having not really had much presence in French public galleries at all. But now her work is going to be filling an entire room in none other than the Picasso Museum in Paris.
Quite a nice homecoming for her. Catherine Carpenter, thank you very much for joining us. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. Now, in the world of diplomacy, there are cushy ambassador postings to placid warm weather capitals full of embassy parties and photo ops. And then there are the serious assignments at the very center of geopolitics. French diplomat Laurent Billy seems to prefer the latter. Since March of last year, he's been France's ambassador to the United States. It's the oldest diplomatic posting in Washington. And prior to that, he spent 4 years as Paris's man in Beijing. Monocle's Seattle correspondent Gregory Scruggs caught up with Billy this week on the sidelines of the Aerospace and Defense Supplier Summit. He asked the ambassador how France's presence at a premier trade show for the defense sector furthers his country's current policy of strategic autonomy.
I think there is a huge misunderstanding about France's quest for strategic autonomy. When we speak about strategic autonomy, it's also about the US to have real partners with capabilities, partners that are really able to be a net contributor to the security of the United States, and also Europe that is able to defend its interests and that doesn't need always to rely on the United States, and especially if there is no willingness. And therefore, when we come to the present defense salon, it's very coherent. We see our aerospace and space ecosystem more as complementary. We are sometimes competitors, but we are also partners. There is a lot of partners to Boeing and French partners to Boeing, and there is also a lot of US partner of Airbus. And I think it's a good example that we are just stronger when we work together.
Now, on Tuesday, the National Assembly passed a resolution supporting the government's Ukraine strategy by quite a large margin. In contrast with the country where you're posted, Ukraine aid continues to be a hot potato in the U.S. Congress. What message can you bring to lawmakers on Capitol Hill in Washington from the French experience about why they should support the war effort in Ukraine? And for that matter, as you travel around the United States, how do you make the case to a skeptical American public whose taxpayers don't necessarily want to fund additional military aid to Ukraine?
I think one of the important points to understand is what happened in Ukraine is not a border issue or a regional conflict. It's somehow an attack on the world that we have been building since the end of World War II. A world that has been built by the United States through the idea of a rule-based international order. And if we let Russia winning in Ukraine, that's a kind of open bar for the one who want to change borders by force. And that's a very bad precedent. What I try to make the point, I of course not have to enter in domestic politics, but just to make the fact right. The fact are that in the last 2 years, Europeans have changed. We are investing again on our defense because the war in Ukraine has been a game changer. We can't anymore harvest the dividend of peace of the last 30 years. We have to prepare for the possibility of a war, a conventional war in Europe. We have also to, another fact that I have to make right is that Europeans are not free rider. In terms of support to Ukraine, we spend much more money to support Ukraine. We are already being spent around $100 billion US dollars. We are committed to 50 plus billion of support to Ukraine for the next coming years. And recently, many European countries, including Germany, France, Denmark, and others, have done also a national pledge. For France, it's $3 billion more just on military support. So on that, just to make sure that we are really doing our part. But the sad reality is that after harvesting for 30 years a dividend of peace, the challenge of Russia is not a challenge that we can face on our own. And we need the U.S. leadership. And I think it's also important for the U.S. because history taught us that when we are late to react, when we are divided, at the end of the day, the cost is much more. And we just think that to show our resolve is the best way to avoid that one day our children will be bringing to something much tougher.
Now, with your postings between both Beijing and Washington, you've had a front row seat to the emerging U.S.-China conflict, what some are frankly calling a new Cold War. How does France navigate those waters, sometimes choppy waters, with regards to the rising tensions between these two superpowers?
Well, I think between China and the U.S., we are not equidistant. We are allies to the United States. At the same time, we do think that we have to manage the competition, and I think the administration is trying to manage the competition, because when the two players are on such scale, an open conflict will be devastating. You may remember that in April last year, the president made some declaration, and I think sometimes they were misquoted, and I think we are to be back to the real text. And one of the main points that he was making was that stepping up the issue of Taiwan was not necessarily a smart idea, because the best that we can achieve regarding Taiwan is a status quo. And when he was discussing with Xi Jinping, he made very clear that France was against the change of status quo by force and that China should refrain to unilateral action. And same way, and I think, by the way, the U.S. administration is very cautious on not to try to step up the issue of Taiwan, because it can just fuel nationalism in China, and that's not helpful.
Now, you certainly have a number of hard power issues to contest with in your role as French ambassador. But, of course, there are soft power matters at hand as well. Your country's hosting the Olympics this summer, and the torch will, after the Paris Olympics in 2024, end up in the hands of Los Angeles 2028. So what is the role of the French embassy in helping your two nations, both the one you represent and the one you're posted to, passing the baton for this global sporting event, promoting, of course, peace and cooperation in a troubled world?
Well, we started a countdown on animating a certain number of encounters between our sport people from both sides of the Atlantic, also some economic actors that could be key on both sides, and of course, helping LA and Paris to connect and have the best possible reception for the mayor of Los Angeles. And I think maybe the governor of California will also travel. So make sure that everything will be fine. But my main message on the issue is just to say to the American people that they are very welcome in Paris. We hope that it will be an incredible game. And I know that the US are really Olympic Games lovers. So please go to Paris. Enjoy the game.
Laurent Billy, France's ambassador to the United States, there speaking to Monocle's Gregory Scruggs. You're listening to The Briefing. And finally, on today's show, the ever-crowded space race these days is a mix of countries and companies working to get rockets off the ground. And with all of these new players, there have been no shortage of failures along the way. Today, it was the turn of Japan's Space One, which was hoping to become the first Japanese company to put a satellite into orbit. Instead, the rocket known as Kairos exploded just a few seconds after launch. Well, the astronomer and science writer David Whitehouse can tell us more and joins me now. David, how big a setback, first of all, is this for Japan's commercial space efforts?
Well, it is a setback. They will be devastated that the first launch of this particular design of rocket has failed this way. And it failed fairly quickly after leaving the pad. And I understand they had to self-destruct it because it might have come down in a populated region in an uncontrolled manner. They'll be very disappointed, particularly for the customer of whom we don't know, of the small satellite they were going to launch. But they are a startup. This type of rocket, solid fuel rocket, is notoriously difficult to get right. If things go wrong, they go wrong catastrophically. So they've got big backers. They've got a long-term plan. So they'll probably write this one down to experience and cross their fingers and try and make sure they understand what had happened so it doesn't happen next time.
Well, and tell us more about Space One, David. What are their ambitions? They want to become a sort of space courier, but how do they compare to some of the bigger commercial players like SpaceX that we all know about?
They're in a different segment of the market. They're in a niche market, which many countries are trying to move into, and that's launching small satellites. That's why their rocket is a very small one and powered by solid fuel, because this limits the size of the satellite you can launch and particularly the type of orbit you can launch it into. And there is seemingly going to be a high demand for small satellites. With today's technology, you can pack a lot into a small satellite, and there could be a lot of applications. In particular, the military are very interested in being able to develop a small satellite. And the rumor is that this particular satellite was for the military, the one that got destroyed in this explosion. They want to be able to have a small satellite with their specialist surveillance equipment on and be able to launch it very swiftly, not in a year's time. They don't want to book a timetable for a launch in a year's time. They want to go to a commercial small satellite launcher literally and say, within a couple of weeks, we want to launch this because there is a military situation on the Earth that they want to surveil. So there is a market for this, not only military, but in other places. And that's what Space One's aiming for, like many other companies in Britain, in Germany, in the United States.
David, is there any debate still at this point, though, over whether this should be, say, the purview of governments instead of companies when you look at a failure like this as well? Or has that debate just been completely settled at this point?
It's receding into the past because governments quite like this. NASA quite likes working with SpaceX because they don't have the responsibility of doing all the technology, of managing all the launches, of building the rockets. And they have a customer. Space One in Japan is providing a service for a customer. And if the rocket blows up, the satellite gets destroyed, the customer gets a refund and a reflight. And that doesn't happen if it's a big government organizing this. It has to be in a market. It has to be cheaper. It has to perform. And if it doesn't perform, there is a payback. So this is seen as good for everybody in the sense it also fosters technology, small companies, the ability to build things, the ability to manage things, an ecology around this new business model space industry. Hopefully, everybody wins.
Just very quickly, finally, at the end, David, is there any other small company that you're looking out for along these lines?
Well, actually, in Scotland, in the Shetland Islands, later this year, there will be a small company which aims to launch for the first time from the British Isles a small rocket and get into this market of launching small satellites. There's a lot of people hoping that that might lead to something. But then again, there's a lot of companies in Japan, in Britain, elsewhere who are also moving into this market as well.
That was David Whitehouse. And that's all the time we have for this edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Lillian Fawcett. Our researcher was George Ruskin, and our studio manager was Tamsin Howard. The Briefing is back tomorrow at the same time. I'm Chris Chermak. Goodbye, and thanks for listening.